The second case for oral argument this morning is Poirier, I hope I'm pronouncing that properly, versus the South Dakota Department of Revenue. This is a limited rehearing granted by this court after its original decision, and the court is sitting with the same five justices that sat in the original case, and therefore welcome back our former member, Justice Robert Amundson, and also welcome back Arthur Rush, the presiding judge of the First Judicial Circuit. Mr. Lawrence Long, the Attorney General of the State of South Dakota, represents the State of South Dakota, and Colette Routel, is that right? Routel represents Poirier. Mr. Long, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The sole remaining issue in this case is whether SDCL 1047B-141, the 15-month statute of limitations relative to motor fuels, or any statute of limitations, operates as a time bar against Muddy Creek's claims for refund of motor fuel taxes. Two members of this court have upheld the 15-month statute. However, two other members of the court have found that because the state exceeded its authority in imposing this tax, the limitation periods imposed by the motor fuel taxation scheme are inapplicable in this case. This statement, if it becomes the holding of the court, will expose the state treasury to refund claims which cannot be calculated and which may go in perpetuity. Second, the court will abandon settled U.S. Supreme Court case law, which is exactly on point. And third, the court will abandon or overrule its own settled case law, which is also on point. At the outset, though, this rehearing is really not about Muddy Creek's refund claim. Muddy Creek has filed a series of refund claims totaling about $940,000 from July of 95 to December of 99. Muddy Creek made those claims as a marketer and a retailer, but those claims have been rejected by the court. Muddy Creek will receive as a consumer, a tribal member consumer, only a tiny fraction of that amount, regardless of what the court holds here today. And so if that was the only issue, we probably wouldn't be here. The real issue today is the big picture. The real issue today is whether the entire state treasury is exposed to motor fuel tax refund claims, and if so, for how long. The potential exposure is enormous. The state first began collecting motor fuel taxes in 1923. Presumably, motor fuel retailers have existed in Indian country since that time. If this court rejects all statutes of limitation, the state treasury is exposed back to 1923. Well, how much money is that? We have attempted to calculate that, and that's an extremely difficult number to try to raise. But let me give you a couple of examples.
Is there any evidence?
It isn't an issue in this case. We're just talking about Muddy Creek. But you're saying that if it opens up Pandora's box or whatever,
absolutely,
the floodgates is...
Absolutely.
Well, but was that ever considered by anybody?
Excuse me?
Is this the first time that's been considered? Would it be? Going back to... I don't remember it's going back to 1923. I'm getting older and I don't remember everything we talked about the last time.
There's no evidence in the record supporting that, is there?
Supporting what?
Supporting anything going back to 1923.
Well, what statute says, or what the decision says, or at least two members of the court have said, that there is no applicable statute of limitations.
Do you think that that permits you to argue outside the record based on what evidence is in there?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm without other method of calling to the court's attention the magnitude of the decision that's been made, or at least that potentially will be made.
But how can you go outside the application period for the refund, which commences in 1995? I mean, the state, in its brief, keeps raising the specter of 1923, but I don't see that coming from the other side. I don't see them asking for refunds back to 1923. They appear to me to be confining themselves to the record, and counsel can certainly speak for herself when she gets up here, but I assumed we had the longest period we were looking at was from 1995 to date.
That's the absolute max. Well, Perhaps it's the maximum for Muddy Creek. Let's assume there's no statute of limitations, though, as the court, at least two members of the court have suggested. Mr. Courier's been a lifelong member of the tribe, and presumably he's bought motor fuels on the reservation during that timeframe. If there is no statute of limitations, does he have a prior claim? And if so, when does it become stale? Or does it ever become stale? I mean, that is the question.
What record has he got to prove what he bought in 1923?
I have no idea.
But as I understand it, too, the court also allowed a substitution of parties here so that the Muddy Creek's claim now becomes the claim of all the other potential consumers, tribal consumers, who purchased from Muddy Creek. So those people would also all be able to make claims back to some period of time.
Well, and as a matter of fact, at least two members of the court addressed the issue because they said that there were tribal member consumers who would be affected by the claim and affected by the decision, even though, arguably, that wasn't before the court in any other capacity other than Muddy Creek's claim.
Let me ask you this.
But there is a statement in the prior decision that says that.
Yeah, but in collecting taxes, you know, and look at, I think, at the Cheyenne, one of the Cheyenne tribe cases, it said that if there's non-member Native Americans, they can be charged a tax, can't they?
Yes.
And also, let's say I've got a construction outfit that's building something there, and I've got people that go in there and buy gas, it's right to charge them. They're non-members of the tribe. They can collect the gas tax from them. So do we know that every one of this $900-some-thousand was paid by tribal members, or do we know that, right?
No, I don't think there's any. In any subsequent refund action, all of that will have to be sorted out in some fashion.
Okay, so there. Thank you.
However, the first and foremost question, and the question for which rehearing has been granted, is what statute of limitations, if any, is applicable?
Before we get there, recently the South Dakota Attorney General's office had what may have been a surprising or a very welcome or a stunning victory in their lawsuit against Banner Health Systems, because this court held that there was an implied, a constructive, a resulting trust in favor of the people of the local communities as against Banner Health Systems, where Banner Health Systems could not sell those systems and then take the money out of state, assuming the state can prove their claim as they've alleged. Why wouldn't the same type of a principle apply on this? Should the state always get the advantage of being able to hold that money in the state in the Banner Health Systems case, and be the implement or the you know, the trustee or the supporter of the trustee, and yet as here, the state. Five people have ruled that they've imposed an improper tax, no jurisdiction to impose this tax, no permission from National Congress to do it. Why should the state be able to hang on to this money under those circumstances when in the background is the Banner Health System case?
I'm not sure that I see the correlation, but let me attempt to answer your question.
And I realize that there is no trust being argued here yet, but it's surprisingly similar, isn't it?
As I understand the rationale of the court and the decision, the court cited to the Huff case and suggested that to take an item through the power of taxation without authority amounts to an unconstitutional taking or taking without due process. It apparently therefore follows, at least in the opinion of some members of the court, that there is no applicable time limit that can be placed upon or time bar that can be placed upon the assertion of that claim. That appears to be what I read
in
the decision.
I don't agree in the sense that the rule in Puryear only applied to Puryear And I don't believe there's any language in there that says it applies back to 1923 or it applies to any cases prior to 1995. I mean, I think it's limited to the facts in that case, and I think it's limited to this case. You certainly have a right to disagree.
We're not able to divine that from the opinion, Your Honor. But let me follow through. I would call, I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court in McKesson dealt with this issue. They dealt with exactly this issue, where the state of Florida had imposed a tax which the U.S. Supreme Court held was preempted by federal law. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the state specifically to impose a relatively short statute of limitations to protect the state's fisc, to protect the state treasury from a multitude of claims, and basically from stale claims, and to allow the state to make reasonable fiscal judgments about the amount of money they had available. Interestingly enough, the state of South Dakota has decided a similar case, and that case is Security State Bank versus Twindle, which is cited in our brief. And it was a case in 1928 that came out of Cottington County. What happened in that case was that the Security National Bank was a national bank, and they had paid personal property taxes on some of their assets imposed by the county of Cottington. And they paid it for several years under the misapprehension that it was actually due and payable, when in fact a good portion of that taxation was preempted by a federal statute which protected national banks. Once they discovered that they had in fact overpaid this illegal tax, this preempted federal tax, they sought a refund. And at that point in time, there were two statutory methods in South Dakota for the obtaining of a refund. One was payment under protest and a suit within 30 days. And the other was a refund or an abatement procedure to make application to the county. The Security National Bank had missed the 30-day payment under protest and suit. They had simply not availed themselves of it. And so they sought relief in the South Dakota Supreme Court, and they sought relief not only under that statute, but they also sought relief under the refund statute. And what the South Dakota Supreme Court said was, you don't qualify under the refund statute, and you missed your opportunity under the 30-day payment under protest, and so you're out of court. And what is a preempted federal tax, which seems to me to be on all fours with McKesson and very similar to what happened here, was precluded by the South Dakota Supreme Court in that case.
Did that have a jurisdictional defect to that tax?
A jurisdictional defect? I think it's more akin to what happened in McKesson, Your Honor, which was there was a special federal statute that required that national banks could only be taxed at the same rate as local banks. It's very similar to that federal line of cases in McKesson and the cases where the states were taxing federal employees' pensions and they were not taxing their own. So I think it is comparable, Your Honor. Now, there's a second case, and that case is called the State of Erdman, and that's in 1989. And in the case of, that was an inheritance tax case. And in the inheritance tax case of the State of Erdman, Mr. Erdman became deceased, and he had a two-year-old daughter who had a substantial inheritance. And the state inheritance tax return was filed. Her estate paid the tax. And subsequently, the federal estate tax return was audited, and numerous errors were discovered, which resulted in a tax back in favor of, or a refund back in favor of the little girl. Well, the administrator of the estate missed the filing deadline, the three-year filing deadline, by 30 days. The South Dakota Supreme Court held that the failure to make the three-year statute of limitations and make the requisite request within 3 years was jurisdictional, and that the statutory remedies that were available were the only remedies available. Now, And interestingly enough, this case law follows McKesson and follows McKesson very closely, because McKesson stands for the proposition that the states can protect themselves through reasonable statutory remedies. We submit that the 15-month statute is a reasonable statutory remedy, which has been enacted by the South Dakota legislature for the exact purpose described in McKesson, which is to protect the fiscal integrity of this state. And this court should allow the 15-month statute and should affirm that the 15-month statute is the appropriate statute in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Okay. Ms. Rotel, you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The 15-month statute of limitations that the department relies on does not limit Mr. Poirier's ability to recover a refund of this illegally collected tax, and there are two main reasons for this. First, under South Dakota law, there is a narrow exception that states no statute of limitations can bar the refund of an illegally collected tax if the property being taxed or the person being taxed was completely outside of the state's taxing jurisdiction. Second, and in the alternative, even if this court decides to overrule that line of cases, it should hold that a 6-year statute of limitations applies. That is, either the 6-year statute of limitations for common law taxpayer actions or the 6-year statute of limitations recently enacted by the South Dakota legislature in Senate Bill 225. Now, I'd like to begin by addressing both of these points in a little more detail.
But you concede that your client is limited then to the period of time after 1995 when he starts filing the applications for the refunds?
We do, Your Honor, and I think there are two reasons for that. In 1995, this court relied on the fact that the legislature included this provision in the motor fuel tax scheme that said the legal incidence of the tax is on the consumer. That's what switched the legal incidence in the state of South Dakota. So before then, there isn't a consumer group that can apply for a refund. The legal incidence of the tax was on either the market or the rack operator. And these folks were not Indians in Indian country at that time. So technically, I think this tax would have to be limited by 1995. And this court also limited its decision by saying that Mr. Poirier had provided the Department of Revenue with notice that he was protesting the tax. And this was a key element of its decision.
So somewhere that period of time is going to fall between 8 years, I guess, or 18 months.
That's
long
correct.
And short of it, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Clear up something for me, if you would, before you start. I recollect that in the previous part of this appeal, Mr. Poirier represented that he did not charge tribal members this tax, that he paid it on his own. So how do any of the tribal members have any claim whatsoever if they did not pay the tax?
Well, Your Honor, this court found that the legal incidence of the tax was on the consumer. Essentially, Mr. Poirier priced his gasoline in accordance with what other gas stations were pricing their gasoline. And his argument was that there was no evidence in the record that other gas stations were able to fully pass through the tax. But this court rejected that and said the consumers were actually bearing the legal incidence of the tax, that it had been passed through to the consumers, and that's why they're in this position now of applying for a refund.
So you're saying that if Station A in Rapid City charged $1.439, that's what your client charged?
That's correct, Your Honor. The evidence in the record showed that he actually priced his gasoline at about one penny above.
No dispute in the 43.9 in Rapid City, the tax is included in that by the seller.
Well, it wasn't really clear on the record, Your Honor, how the tax was set. Whether the market
take notice that they don't eat the tax themselves, they add it on. I mean, whatever.
That is what this court found.
You talk to anyone who runs a gas station, they say they're on a small margin and most of it goes to tax. You know.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
We basically said, or part of this court basically said, that we're disregarding Mr. Poirier's representation that he did not collect this tax from the tribal members, that he paid it on his own, and basically the finding of this court stands over his own statement that he didn't collect it.
That's true, Your Honor. I think it's important to discuss the limitations on this rule that no statute of limitations can apply. The general rule, of course, is that statutes of limitation are valid and that they can bar what would normally be a meritorious tax refund claim. South Dakota has adopted a narrow exception to the rule, and it deals with jurisdictional defects in a tax proceeding. If the state didn't have jurisdiction over the property being taxed or didn't have jurisdiction over the person or property because it was tax exempt, this exception is extremely narrow, and it doesn't encompass a lot of the examples that the department has used before you today. For example, most tax refund cases arise out of applying for a refund under a statutory scheme. If I'm a gas station owner in Pierre, and I'm transferring gasoline from my tanker truck to an above-ground storage tank, and I spill a large quantity on the ground, under South Dakota's motor fuel tax scheme, I can apply for a refund if it's greater than 500 gallons of gas. That's a right that the legislature has given me, and of course, the legislature can limit that right and has to a certain amount of time, a 15-month time period. And that's because the legislature has jurisdiction over me and has jurisdiction over my activities. That's completely valid, and that's like State versus Erdman, which the department cited before you. It was a mistakenly paid tax that wasn't under duress or coercion. There would have been no common law right. They had to apply under a statutory scheme. The second example is an illegal or unconstitutional tax. Not all illegal or unconstitutional tax can be applied for a refund regardless of statutes of limitation. Most of the cases cited by the department deal with a commerce clause. In those cases, the state is taxing an out-of-state corporation doing business in the state at a higher rate than an in-state corporation. Well, clearly the tax is illegal, it's discriminatory, but the state has jurisdiction to apply the tax. And courts have found that because it says actually the state doesn't need to refund any money to the out-of-state corporation. It can just go back and retroactively apply a greater tax to in-state businesses. The state has jurisdiction. That's not a jurisdictional defect. And so Security National Bank versus Twind, which the department cited, has no relevance either. As I stated, this is a very narrow exception that deals with jurisdictional defects. And there are three reasons why this court shouldn't overrule it. First, if statute of limitations apply to the recovery of these illegal taxes where the state had no jurisdiction to apply it, there's no incentive for the state to stop adopting illegal taxes or to even stop collecting when the court has held that the tax is illegal. The state knows it can retain a large amount of its illegally gotten gains, and so in this case, the South Dakota Department of Revenue could subvert the federal right that Mr. Poirier has to be tax exempt. Second, contrary to the department's contentions, retention of the rule doesn't impede the state's ability to engage in sound fiscal planning. The state has been on notice since 1995 that this tax may be declared illegal, and not simply by Mr. Poirier's protestations, but 1995 was when the United States Supreme Court handed down Oklahoma Tax Commission versus Chickasaw Nation. And in that case, the court reaffirmed the general rule. It said you have to have unmistakably clear congressional authorization in order for the tax to be valid on Indians and Indian country. At that time, South Dakota had participated as an amicus and had done all the legislative research, had looked at the statutory scheme, and saw there was no mention of Indians or Indian country in the legislative history or in the statute. And so the department at least knew that it was debatable whether the tax would be illegal. But instead of taking steps such as segregating the funds or tracking them to determine how much money we were talking about and to better plan for its highway development, instead the department tried to prevent our client from challenging the tax. Mr. Poirier, just 3 weeks after Chickasaw was handed down, applied for a marketer license. And he was denied that license. And the hearing examiner concluded he was denied it because, quote, the department denied the application because the department feared the applicant may challenge South Dakota's interpretation of the state taxing authority on Indian reservations. So this is a statement in 1995. The department knew Mr. Poirier was going to challenge the taxation scheme then and could have taken the steps it needed to protect the state's fiscal soundness. I think all of these cases demonstrate that this court should grant Mr. Poirier's full refund. But even if the court decides to apply a statute of limitations to this claim, it should be a six-year limitations period. And this is based on the plain language of the other statutes of limitation that are in contention here. First, if you look at the 15-month statute of limitations, it requires that any claim for a refund of motor fuel be made to the Secretary of the Department of Revenue within 15 months from when the gas was originally purchased. But the statutory scheme in Chapter 47B only lists certain cases when you can apply for a refund. The department says that Mr. Poirier could have applied for a refund under Section 131.2. But that says a state or federal court of final appeals must find that the taxation of the purchaser use of the fuel is preempted by federal law or unconstitutional before a consumer can apply for a refund. Obviously, in this case, Mr. Poirier was the first person to apply for a refund, and he couldn't apply under this provision under the plain meaning of the statute. So the 15-month statute of limitations just doesn't apply here. The three-year statute of limitations that the department offers up is in Title 10, Chapter 59, Section 19, and it deals with overpaying
taxes.
Why
wouldn't 15-year apply right after we make a final decision? 15 months. Couldn't they come in then?
Because, Your Honor, I can't think that the legislature would have intended Mr. Poirier to go through all these administrative hurdles when the department had no authority to grant him a refund.
But I said it, if it mentions a federal or state court decided, then it triggers in 15 months, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, the statute itself says that a consumer may apply for a refund if there's a state or federal court of final appeals decision already in place.
Well, this would be that, wouldn't it?
It would, and I think it would apply if this court rejects our first holding to subsequent consumers who are applying for a refund. But the initial consumer applying for a refund, the legislature apparently made the determination that the court was in the best position to determine whether a statute was illegal or constitutional and not the Department of Revenue. And so the department doesn't make that determination in its refund proceeding. So Mr. Poirier is the first person who challenged the legality of the tax couldn't use this provision. If you look at the provision for overpaid taxes in Title 10, Chapter 59, Section 19, it talks about allegedly overpaid taxes. Now, although there's no case law on this point, it seems to make sense that what the legislature was talking about was a mistakenly overpaid tax. The Department of Revenue mistakenly assessed a taxpayer at a level higher than was required under the statute, or the taxpayer mistakenly paid more tax than was actually due under the statutory scheme. There's no indication that that is the way to apply for a refund for an illegal tax. And so what you're left with is a six-year statute of limitations. It's either the six-year limitations period that was recently enacted by this court in Senate Bill 225, or it's the six-year statute of limitations on a common law action.
So if we adopt the six-year statute of limitation, you're saying that precludes anyone from 1923 coming in, because we're saying that statute of limitations is whatever time it is valid. You aren't contesting that a statute of limitations isn't valid? Passed under that Supreme Court case?
Well, we are saying, Your Honor, that this court should find that statutes of limitation don't apply to this kind of tax. Mm-hmm. And the alternative we're arguing, if it is going to apply one, it's certainly not the 15
months. I thought the U.S. Supreme Court says it was appropriate for the state to have statute of limitation.
The United States Supreme Court of McKesson was interpreting the United States Constitution's due process clause. But these South Dakota cases are based on different principles. There are two sort of reasons given by the South Dakota Supreme Court. And the first reason is that the tax is void from the inception because the state had no jurisdiction over the property. And therefore, the mere lapse of time doesn't give that tax any validity. It's called the void ab initio doctrine. We actually cite a Wisconsin decision in our brief, and Wisconsin is a state that also applies this rule that if the property or the person is exempt from taxation or outside of the state's taxing jurisdiction, then statutes of limitation don't apply. So that's the first ground. The second ground seems to be the South Dakota Constitution's due process clause. And so this court may decide that it should interpret that due process clause differently from the federal Constitution's due process clause in light of McKesson. But there is certainly an independent ground that this court has given that is not affected by McKesson. It is a state law rule. If there are no other questions.
We don't chastise counsel for quitting early in this court.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Long.
Thank you, Your Honor.
10 minutes, sir.
A couple of points. I take issue with the suggestion that Mr. Puryear couldn't find a way to get into court. I will call the court's attention to a document in the record, which is DORC, which would be in the settled record from the administrative law judge. And this is a letter which was sent to Stephen Johnson and Mr. Puryear's lawyers on September 3rd, 1996. Mr. Johnson on Mr. Puryear's behalf had just submitted a refund claim for $89,000, alleging that his refund was governed by the Chickasaw Nation case. And and on September 4th, 1996, the Department of Revenue responded and outlined all of the reasons that they thought that the tax was properly imposed. They cited the Hayden-Cartwright Act. They cited all of the case law that we argued to this court previously. They cited the provision of the South Dakota Constitution, which dedicates all state motor fuel taxes to the state highway fund. And in that regard, I would point out that SDCL 1047B131.2 is not a statute of limitations at all. It is simply statutory authorization for the Department of Revenue to remove money from the state highway fund for purposes of making refunds, which they are powerless to do because the Constitution makes that a dedicated fund. 131.2 is not a statute of limitations. It's simply one of the authorizing statutes which allows the Department of Revenue to take money out of the fund. And I submit to you, in the absence of the previous decision by this court finding that the motor fuel tax was preempted, the state would be precluded by the trust fund doctrine and the Constitution from taking money out of the trust fund for purposes of making these refunds, because it would be an unconstitutional expenditure. Now, all of this was explained to Mr. Puryear in this letter, which went on 3 pages, but I would like to read to you the last paragraph of the letter. And it says, your May 13th letter says you are prepared to litigate. We are also prepared to litigate and to cooperate with you to expedite this litigation. If you choose to bring an action, we will cooperate to move the litigation forward quickly. However, because the department believes that Muddy Creek is obligated to collect and remit the taxes at issue for at least the above reasons, we must respectfully deny your request for a refund. Now, within 30 days after the issuance of that letter, Mr. Puryear had the right to bring a cause of action to test exactly the issues that he is here arguing and has been here arguing. He did not, in fact, do anything by way of bringing an action for refund or bringing litigation for nearly 3 years after that. And so I think it's inappropriate for counsel to suggest that Mr. Puryear couldn't find his way to the courthouse.
Let me just get clarification on what the real dispute is here. As I understand it, you concede that Mr. Puryear does have a valid claim from and after 1997. And that the dispute here is really about claims from 1995 to 1997. Is that accurate?
As it relates to Mr. Puryear as a consumer, yes. But the larger question is, if there's no statute of limitations that applies to Mr. Puryear, does a statute of limitations apply to anybody else? And if that's the case, how do we make a distinction between which statute we apply? If there's no statute of limitations applicable to Mr. Puryear, how do other principles of law dictate to us what statute of limitations, if any, ought to apply to other tribal member consumers who have purchased motor fuel?
All right,
are presumably entitled to a refund.
Let me ask you your position on that date then. Would you concede that tribal member consumers can claim from and after 1997 for any tax they actually paid. Now, that's the 15-month period that is applicable, that you say is applicable to Mr. Puryear. Would it also be applicable to those tribal members? Assuming that they paid it, because I know Mr. Puryear said that he didn't collect it from them, but assuming that it's shown that they can show that they did in fact pay it.
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Now, hadn't you suggested in the alternative that there was a 3-year statute of limitations out there that might have some effect if the shorter term one didn't?
Well, yes, Your Honor. There is a 3-year general statute of limitations, a 3-year refund statute of limitations, which is found in 1059. It is a generic statute which I think the legislature passed in an attempt to simplify, if you will, the various different types of refund timeframes and processes that were out there in the Department of Revenue. Subsequent to that, of course, the 15-month statute was passed with reference specifically to motor fuel taxes.
So the 15-month one's a newer, more specific?
Yes.
All right.
In the absence of the, if the 15-month statute did not exist, Your Honor, then clearly the 3-year one would be the appropriate one. I would again like to discuss Twindle and the subsequent case, which is Security National Bank of Watertown versus Young. After the Twindle case, the lawyer for the Security National Bank, of course, obviously still wanted his tax refund, and he brought suit in U.S. District Court, and that case ultimately ended up in the U.S. 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. And the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals in that case held that the, in response to your question, Justice Rush, held that the taking by the South Dakota taxing authorities would be an unconstitutional deprivation contrary to the 14th Amendment, and they cite Ward versus Board of County Commissioners, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case that stands for that proposition. However, they in that case suggested that a common law cause of action may well exist for taxes paid under coercion and duress, and therefore would get the claimant outside of the two statutes of limitation which then existed and which the South Dakota Supreme Court imposed. As a matter of factual finding, the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals said that the general South Dakota statute of limitations applicable to an ordinary common law action would be 6 years. And so they suggested that the 6-year statute would apply to this common law cause of action. However, then they ultimately determined that the taxpayer had not met the standard for establishing coercion and duress and ultimately continued to deny his claim. And so consequently, the Security National Bank never did get their money back. I submit that McKesson has overruled that portion of the Security National Bank versus Young, which goes into the analysis of duress and coercion, because as McKesson teaches, coercion and duress is a pre-deprivation remedy, and the coercion and duress analysis is only appropriate when the court is analyzing a pre-deprivation remedy. We've conceded that there was no meaningful pre-deprivation remedy here, and consequently, we don't think that coercion and duress is properly before the court in terms of the factual analysis that would otherwise be available.
Do you think that McKesson was a lack of jurisdiction or unconstitutional tax, and is there a distinction?
I think there is not a distinction. The last paragraph of Twindle, Your Honor, talks about, the very last sentence of Twindle basically says, for cases in which, and it's talking about the distinction between the payment under protest and sue after 30 days or the abatement and refund process, and it makes the distinction that the abatement and refund process is for basically clerical errors and where it's obvious that something wrong has been done. But then it says about the the situation where the federal statute preempted or protected the property. It says, while for cases in which the legality or illegality of the tax necessarily involves the determination of questions of law calling for the exercise of strictly judicial functions, payment under protest and the other provisions of the suit statute afford the exclusive remedy. And so, I think, Your Honor, whether the tax is preempted by federal law or is unconstitutional under state law, or the taxpayer is exempt for some reason, the fact is it's an illegal tax. It's illegal as to that taxpayer. And if it's illegal as to that taxpayer, McKesson teaches that at some point there is an appropriate statute of limitations that the legislature can enact. There isn't any claim that is not subject to some legislative discretion in terms of an establishing a period of repose or a period when the claim becomes too stale.
In relation to any statute of limitations, do you urge that the statute of limitations time is triggered by the purchase of the gasoline in a consumer's at the time by a consumer or at the time by anyone?
The statute says, I think measures the time from the time of the purchase or the submission of the return. At least the 15-month statute does. I think the 3-year statute has similar language.
All right. Justice Amundson, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Court will be in recess till 11 o'clock.